Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome to the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Nissa Pearson of Jeunesse Herb and Culinary Center. This space, the Jeunesse Herb and Culinary Center, is very multifaceted. It's hard to explain in one short sentence because there's a lot of work that went into it before, a lot of travels, a lot of education. And what it really is this amazing kind of classroom, educative forum for, you know, smart ideas of organic, fair trade, cuisine, food, feeding the community. But we'll discuss a little more about that space itself. But first, we'll introduce you to Nissa. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. I had the privilege of working or shooting in Nissa's space a while back. And let me tell you, if you're looking for a photo space, this is one of the most pimped out kitchens in Brooklyn that I've seen in a while. But I was actually led to you because of your classes. Jacques from Palo Santo had, you know, forwarded me on and said, oh, you should do a class here, or you should check out what Nissa is doing. She knows so much about everything, worldly cuisine. You grew up in Santa Monica, California, which is plush and ripe of everything all
Beach
year
bum.
Round. Yeah. What was your first introduction to food and cuisine or love of that?
Well, I think that for a lot of people that are from California, abundance of produce is kind of just a natural part of it. So that, for one, I mean, you know, we grew up with produce, fresh produce around us year round, and it wasn't from far, like if you're at other places. But I think probably the first real experience with food that we had is, as children, we lived in Central America. And I think that for me was kind of like the beginning of really understanding people's relationship to food in a different way. So,
yeah.
I mean, I think that that would be the first step of a lot more.
Why that move away from Central Coast or Southern California to Central America?
Well, we have one of those unique stories where we had a bitter custody battle in California, which led to all of us wanting to stay with our father. And this was during the late 80s, during the Iran-Contra scandal. And so my father technically kidnapped us and brought us to Nicaragua.
Yeah.
And the Nicaraguans stamped us in, gave us residency, and didn't give us back. So we lived down in Central America for about 3 years, 3.5 years.
Yeah, and this was during the mid-80s.
Yep.
And what was Nicaragua like? Was it considered a third world country? Was it considered, you know, affluent for Americans?
No, it was considered a war zone at that time. I mean, there was bridges blown up in a lot of places. There was tanks rolling down the streets of Managua. As a child, as an adult, I understood that, as you asked me that question.
Yeah.
But as a child, I would have seen it completely differently. We saw it as, you know, a place where we played, we ate, we learned. For us, it was really no different. There was not a lot of Americans down there. Americans weren't typically allowed in Nicaragua. It was definitely more occupied, let's call it, by a lot of the Eastern European, kind of more communist people, like Eastern European or Eastern Germans and stuff like that. So we were just a very few Americans that were down there.
So did you ever feel indigenous? Did you ever feel like you belonged to Nicaragua?
Completely. And I know that after we left for a long time, I mean, and to this day still, like, I really feel more Central American than I do California, for sure.
Yeah, and what was the cuisine? What was the landscape like?
I mean, it was amazing. I mean, it was one of the first places that I'd ever been that people made everything from scratch. So one of the things that I'll never forget is that for every meal you had, there was a new juice. It was kind of like a new fruit just was born in every single minute, you know, and incredible flavors, vibrant colors, amazing.
Yeah, I mean, what kind of new juices, what fruits were discovered down there?
For instance, one of my family's favorite is the pitaya and lime juice. So, which ultimately the pitaya is basically a cactus fruit, but it's just a certain variety that's grown down there. And it's this great, like, magenta pink cactus fruit that they make, and they cut it with lime and probably tons of sugar.
Yeah.
And it was just this fuchsia colored concoction that was like amazing to us.
So, I mean, it was a completely different palate too than what you were used to from Santa Monica.
Yes.
What other kind of foods were new to you?
There was a lot of cabbages. Things were, you know, there was a lot of salts, like is typical for Central American food. So like pickled cabbages, a lot of stews of beef, stews of chicken, with tons of chilies and tons of vegetables. One of the things I really remember as a child loving was the chayote squash, which is still to this day. I mean, it's kind of a, you know, blander, gentler squash, but I remember loving it as a child, and I really enjoyed that. And of course, the gallo pinto, which is still to this day, I'm trying to perfect how you make it taste like
What is the gallo pinto?
It's beans and rice fried together.
Yeah.
And, you know, the origin is debatable. Some say Costa Rica, some say Nicaragua, but it's debatable. And I swear that the real flavor comes from the old cast iron pans that they've just never cleaned, because I can't get it to taste like that.
Yeah, yeah. Seasoned, as they call
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Yeah. So how many years were you actually down in Central America?
About 3.5. We were in Nicaragua for a year and a half, Costa Rica for a year and a half, and then about a half a year spent. We drove down there, and then we came back on a boat from Panama.
Yeah. And back to Santa Monica.
We actually went back to Minnesota, where my father was from. So I have a also deep connection to Minnesota.
Yeah, I was about to say, a lot of culture shocks going on here.
Exactly.
So then you were dealing with a lot of Midwest foods.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
And wild rice, I guess. That's all. That's the limit of what I know from Minnesota.
Yeah, I mean, I went to high school and college in Minnesota, and the foods. I mean, I don't recall the foods all that. You know, that much, but certainly, you know, and no offense to the Minnesotans, you know, but there can be some blandish foods out there. A lot of casseroles, hot dish, all that kind of stuff. But that's actually how I started to cook, where I actually started to take all these dishes and want to make them my own. When we were in high school, we started to play sports and stuff like that, like all, you know, great American kids. And we would want to feed ourselves after sports, and you know, we open up the kitchen cupboard and there's macaroni and cheese. I hated macaroni and cheese, so I tried to concoct my own creations using noodles and different soup mixes and flavors and herbs and stuff like that. So Minnesota food is actually what got me cooking.
Yeah, because the lack of all the flavor profiles that you were used to or hoping for.
As somebody who was from California with the, you know, experience of Central America, I knew that there was a lot more that I needed to, that I could use. And I mean, I think that if I had to describe my cooking, it would be that it's very diverse. It utilizes everything that I've seen, tasted, and have yet to experience. So I think that was the great part about when I started to cook, is that I had had this experience of a child in Central America and also, you know, a kid born in California in the world of produce. So it was an easy transition into using what the world has to offer.
Yeah. And I mean, in high school, you were cooking for yourself. In college, you had Mrs. Dorm Room and you were feeding fellow college students. Was that a dinner club? Was that a party? Or was that just you cooking away?
It was just me cooking. I mean, I had... I lived in a house with 8 other girls, and as a...
I think they call that a convent, right?
Yeah, I don't think that's what you can call this one, but maybe my room.
Yeah.
But the ultimately, it was just I started cooking and people, you know, people wanted to eat the food. I enjoyed cooking for a lot of people. And that's kind of when my love of cooking for a lot of people, showing people how easy it was. You know, we'd watch, I remember like Melrose Place was on TV. So people would come over for like pots of chili and things like that. It was nothing elaborate by any means, but it was better than cafeteria food.
Yeah. And, but it gave you that sense of entertaining, which,
you
know, later rolled itself into, you know, dinner parties and Sunday suppers at Jeunesse.
Exactly.
And then after college, you went West Coast again to Oregon.
Yeah, I moved to, I had graduated from college and, you know, at that time, most people kind of go home to where their parents are living. And as you can probably understand, I have a unique father and he was in Grand Forks, North Dakota, getting his pilot's license. And so I went to Grand Forks, North Dakota, and I had a dog at the time. I was one of the few people that had a dog in college. And so my father had rented me this little country home in North Dakota. So imagine what that means. It was like 100 miles of wheat on one side, 100 miles of sunflower on the other. So I stayed there for a little while and kind of went a little bit crazy and decided to move to Eugene, Oregon in hopes of discovering, you know, good agriculture and food. And I wanted to grow. I wanted to garden. So I moved there and it was an incredible place. I lived there 3.5 years. I learned so much about organics, farming, gardening, eating, cooking, seasons. It was one of the few places I've lived where seasons were so profound. I mean, like you couldn't wait for the pears to come in. You couldn't wait for hazelnuts. And it was really... it was really a superb experience for me. And after 3.5 years, I discovered that I wasn't a hippie and I might not belong there, but it really served its purpose with me, for sure.
So you were enrolled in the University of Oregon?
No, I did some recreational kind of classes and stuff like that. And I had a neighbor at the time who was in charge of the urban farming program, which was more for recreational kind of things. So we did a lot with that. And, you know, that's where I learned all of the gardening, you know, everything from pruning to you name it. I built my own greenhouses, started everything from seed. I had like about an acre garden at the end, grew absolutely everything, which is also where I started to grow all my own herbs and started experimenting with cooking with them, growing specialty herbs. So I think that also is kind of what contributes to, you know, my recipe creations and stuff is because I have been a gardener. Since I moved to New York, I kind of haven't been able to find the land, but
yeah, there are rooftops everywhere though.
Yeah, no, I know, but it's not so easy to rooftop garden.
Yeah.
You need your landlord to say it's okay.
Yeah. Or just not tell them.
Oh,
but so after Oregon, you moved back to Santa Monica and started cooking a little bit more from, you know, your origins.
Yeah, I moved back to Southern California because at that point, you know, when I discovered I wasn't a hippie, I realized that a person had to try and make more than $10 an hour. And so I saw that the people in Hollywood were, and so I figured it must be easy down there. So I moved back to Southern California in the San Diego area, and I started teaching classes recreationally, more of as a hobby, and that's when I got into the herb business.
Yeah, I like the herb business.
One of my bar introductions. Yeah, I'm in the herb business.
Yeah, because most people in San Francisco are in the herb business as well. So you were in San Diego cooking about, but there was a point where you stumbled on this glorious, gigantic basil field. Can you tell us a little about that story?
Yeah. So looking for a job in Southern California, I have this habit of trying to apply for jobs I'm not qualified for. You should be very wary of that before you go into like brain surgery or something, because I really feel like I can learn on the job. So I was driving out to this huge garden center to apply for this like manager of the entire garden center. It was like 200 acres of gardens. I drove by this huge basil field in, it's actually kind of in between Oceanside, California and Fallbrook. And I didn't understand what it was. Why was there a huge basil field in the middle of nowhere? What was it for? And so I began to kind of drive around and find the entrance. And I finally did. And I found this little farmhouse. And, you know, I walked in and I was like, what are you guys? I would like a job here. And they looked at me like I was crazy. And but it turns out that it was a company called Herbtime Farms, which is one of the largest fresh herb growers on the large scale market. And they called me back, gave me a job, and I worked there for a while and learned all about, you know, corporate workplace and mass markets for food. And it was pretty interesting.
Yeah, because who did they grow for? Was it for local supermarkets, chefs, or was it nationally distributed?
Everything. It was nationally distributed in the United States and Canada, and it was for large retailers, wholesalers, and also chefs. So, you know, back then there was not the local movement that there is now so much. So a lot of the fresh herbs were provided by these large companies that did, you know, that also provided for the retail. So there was tons of chefs all over the country that we were servicing, some of the best restaurants. It was a pretty unique experience, and it ultimately brought me to where I am today.
Yeah. Well, on that note, we're going to take a quick break, you know, see how Nissa went from selling herb nationally to exploring it internationally. But first, a quick word from our sponsor. Wanted to thank White Oak Pastures. Their cattle are raised in a manner that is and has stood the test of time. Begins with southern sunshine, unpolluted country air, and fertile coastal soil. The cattle are allowed to roam the pastures and graze freely on sweet native grasses all of their lives. White Oak Pastures all-natural grass-fed beef has been available in all of the Whole Food stores in the Mid-Atlantic states. We hope that you will support their program through your purchase of our beef through one of the Whole Food stores. For more info, go to whiteoakpastures.com. We'll be right back. Hey, and welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Nissa Pearson of Journeys Culinary and Herb Center. And we were just talking about herbs in general. I guess I have to watch out about the pluralism of that. You were working for a large herbs grower in California for a while. I think you worked for a couple in California, correct?
Yeah, after working for Herbtime, I moved to Jacobs Farm Del Cabo, which is an organic company that specializes in all organic fresh herbs, and also they specialize in cherry tomatoes and some other things. And they grow in California up in the Pescadero area, as well as Baja California. So I worked for them for a while as well.
Yeah, and when did you get tired of the West Coast and decided to go into the, well, now wintry, pale New York?
That was when I met the Israelis.
Yeah. Let's hear about these Israelis.
So I, you know, I had it's funny because now today in life, I've had so much experience working with the Israelis that a lot of people think that I'm Israeli and Jewish and all of this. And, you know, as a child living in Central America and Southern California, I hadn't met Israelis, honestly. I mean, so it was kind of, it's a unique story, but eventually we had been doing some business with some Israelis when I was working at Jacob's Farm, and they had their company in New York, and they offered me a job, and I had never been to the East Coast, never been to New York, so of course I took the job. I remember calling my father, and he said, everybody should live in New York at some part of their life. So
where in the world was he when he said that?
He was in Southern California. And so I did, and it's interesting because it's the longest place I've lived. Mm-hmm. You know, I've lived here 9 years now, and I've never lived anywhere so long.
Yeah.
So obviously, you know, for me, it was certainly culture shock, but it was home. It was the first time I felt like I was a part of the world versus just part of, you know, somewhere. And, you know, which I think is an interesting concept today because so many people are, you know, hitting on that local button. And for me, I'm still global. You know, that's kind of my pulse. My pulse is on the global level. I like being a part of the world. So,
yeah. But it seems like you've conflated all those experiences from traveling into a more local and regional scale as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the things that I've learned by traveling so much, you know, I've spent the last 10 years after working for the Israeli company and starting my own import company, you know, I've traveled substantially the last 10 years all throughout South America, Mexico, Europe, the Middle East. And one thing I've discovered is that in all of these cultures, people really do place a huge emphasis on their community. And, you know, I hadn't really lived in that in the United States until I lived in Brooklyn and New York. And so, you know, after being here a while, it felt like kind of just like the next step to kind of give back to my community, which wasn't necessarily only what we could find here, but what we can find everywhere. What I can, like, I feel like my local contribution is sharing what the world has to offer with my community. You know?
Yeah, no, it's a very... I always think back to elementary school when you have like the diorama of all the planets.
Right.
And that seems so small, but relevant, it's so much larger than just Earth. Or you see Jupiter or Saturn for the first time, that, you know, it's a very small world. And, you know, the terminology of local, regional, all that kind of stuff sometimes get hyper criticized. Whereas, you know,
well, I think that's a unique, I mean, I think that that's a really interesting topic because where we live in Brooklyn and, you know, most of the cities I've lived in the United States, Santa Monica, San Francisco, San Diego, Minneapolis, you know, all these are very kind of progressive food thinking communities. But, you know, with my experience in that mass market business of selling herbs, you realize that there's a large country that we have out there, and not everybody eats locally, and not everybody shops at their farmer's market. And I think it's a unique perspective to really understand who's out there. I mean, I'm reminded, you know, every time I drive out to the tip of Long Island that we're really no different than any other state in the country. We have all different kinds of people that shop at all different kinds of places. And so I think it's really important that we look at how to educate people on all topics of food. I mean, I've passed the part where, you know, in my younger years where I was really kind of like preaching what I wanted everyone to think and how I wanted them to think, to where I just want to now provide people with information and it's up to them to think how they want to think. And I believe people, the more good, true information they have, make better choices.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you see how political food can be, too.
Yes.
And it must have been eye-opening when you were working for the Israeli company that you were actually importing herbs from both Israel and Palestine.
Right. That was one of the highlights of my herb life, because in theory, it was this great, amazing concept where, you know, you were... Palestinians and Israelis were working together, and it was true on this really small scale. You know, when you travel there, you know, regardless of how you feel about the politics of it or whose land it is, everybody, there's a lot of people that get along, that have gotten along for years, that have worked together for years. And so it's always an interesting perspective to be there versus what you see everybody else thinking. You know, we ran into tons of people throughout the United States that refuse to buy, you know, Israeli products. And again, it's about education. For instance, we had the problem recently in peppers. We were importing hothouse peppers from Israel, and some places said, we refuse to buy, you know, peppers grown on Palestinian land. But the truth is that because of the USDA, you can only get peppers into the United States from this really small section of land that is like not controversial. It's totally Israeli. So, you know, there's always more to the story than meets the eye. And I feel privileged to get to travel to a lot of these places to really learn what the story is.
Yeah. Well, in 2005, you struck it out on your own, yeah, creating Jeunesse International. What was that business?
It was an import business. I basically, you know, took what I had been doing and started my own business. And we started to import fresh herbs and peppers and tomatoes, and then we branched out into fair trade fruits, and all of it was organic.
Yeah. Can you define fair trade? I think it's often, you know, not explained enough.
Well, I mean, the definition of fair trade is, there's a lot of different ways you can define it, depending on who you are. There are certifying agencies, there are certain labels, like there's the one label that, you know, is probably most predominant in the United States. It's used on coffee and teas and chocolates, and, you know, that is Fairtrade USA, and they're a certifying agency, and so there's a number of certifying agencies all over the world, so depending on which certifying agency, they're all different qualifications, but ultimately, you know, for me, the definition is paying people fair wage for their product and, you know, not taking advantage of them on both sides, which is a really huge problem in the American market of food. You know, we import a substantial amount of our food, and yet we have really no idea what we're doing, both to local populations and global populations, that we're not paying them enough, and we're not contributing back enough into the long-term sustainability of it all.
Yeah. It's fascinating you say both local, you know, in that statement. Do you feel like we pay enough for local workers in the you know, American workforce?
No.
As far as, you know, creating the foods that we eat, too.
I mean, I think that, again, you know, it's, there's ultimately, no, I think that we don't, we want food for as cheap as we can get it, you know, and it's not cheap to produce food.
Because is fair trade a stamp that can be applied to national products?
No, not yet. I mean, that's, yeah, kind of one of the controversies. You know, we've seen it a lot in a lot of the fruits where, you know, there's all these fair trade stamps for global fruits, but not for local fruits. For instance, apples. Now, in Europe, it's a little bit different because they can have fair trade, you know, apples. Here we don't have the fair trade stamp on apples because of our own apple industry, but they're working on those kind of things. And, you know, I'm a big proponent of getting a local fair trade kind of stamp. We wanted to do that in the herb category. We were actually working on trying to get the Palestinian herbs fair trade, you know, approved. And in the process, we wanted to get small USA growers as well. So,
yeah, it's kind of fascinating that that doesn't exist. I mean, it just seems, yeah, I know you shrug your shoulders, but I mean, it does. It seems like a given or an assumed to me that it's there, but, you know, you can be buying, everyone, you know, talks about the terrible large companies mass producing, you know, certain foods, but it doesn't talk about how to, you know, figure out which companies are good nationally.
Yeah, I think that ultimately, I mean, I agree, and it's a big problem, but I think that we have a larger problem in the sense that the fair trade label and the fair trade certification for produce in general, it's very difficult because the market doesn't want to pay what the fair trade premiums are. And so regardless of, even if the, let's say the, you know, Washington apple people or the New York apple people can get a fair trade stamp, they're still not going to be making enough money as they you know, for their apples.
Yeah.
So there's kind of a larger problem in the sense that our markets are still underpaying growers. And, you know, do I have the answer to that? Please don't ask, because I don't. But, you know, certainly we know that farmers need to make more money.
Yeah. I mean, do you still work in the trade?
I dabble in the trade now. I do some consulting work and things like that. And we're actually helping some people organize some local herb growers.
Oh, cool.
Things like that. But for the most part, it's a very, very, very stressful business. It's pretty much a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week job. That you need to be on your toes nonstop. And, you know, for me, after doing it for about 10 years, I didn't dedicate a whole lot of time to myself or my own life. And so I'm trying to take some time to do that. But I still am a big global grower advocate. And I'd like to continue to work both with local growers and global growers and trying to get them to markets at fair prices.
Yeah.
Like a revolutionary.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it shows in Journeys and in the center itself, if you just go look at the class list, it's not just using seasonal ingredients. It's about bringing outside global influences. You have a couple really cool upcoming classes, something as simple as, you know, cooking with hearty greens or meatballs. But then you see things like Chinese soups, which so happens to be right near Chinese New Year. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, when you do Sunday suppers, it's often more global or ethnic cuisine than it is, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's, again, I think a lot of our classes are really a product of my interests. I mean, I think that's one of the great things about having your own company is that you can have your own interests come to fruition. And the classes, I mean, I try and come up with classes. And the whole idea of creating Journeys' classes in the first place was to, because I didn't want people to be bored in cooking classes. I wanted people to have a full hands-on experience and really enjoy and be able to take away something. So I think that a lot of the worldly influences are important because the world is small. Ingredients are becoming more accessible, even locally. And so I think it's important that people learn, you know, how to use everything. And, you know, I think fusion's okay.
Yeah.
We have a kind of a little bit of a controversy these days with that, but I think it's okay.
Yeah, I think everyone is fused.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think there's anyone that is still, you know, 100% this, 100% that. I wouldn't call it myopic, but, you know, singularly focused anymore. It's about collection of past influences and, you know, experiences. But I do suggest that anyone who has not taken a class at Journeys, and it's GERNIS.com, check out their class schedule, because you really do see the world in a beautiful little kitchen in Park Slope. Check it out, especially during the dearth of winter, when you can bring so much spice and life to food through Nissa's travels and experiences. Thank you so much for being on the show. I don't see this as the last time as you being our herb consultant here.
Nice.
Excellent. And you've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com, and hope to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Again, a big shout out to White Oak Pastures for sponsoring the show. Have a good one.